You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. In the first part of the program, we heard about the economic costs of racism within the U.S., but that interplay of race and economics isn't only an American issue. A year ago, in August 2021, a severe earthquake struck the southwestern peninsula of Haiti, killing more than 2,000 people and leaving over 500,000 in need of humanitarian assistance. The recent natural disaster added insult to injury for Haiti, a country still recovering from the scars of a much deeper, man-made economic devastation that was centuries in the making. Today, many Americans know Haiti as an aid state, a country defined by foreign dollars and political instability. But for much of its history, cash flowed in the other direction. In 1804, the former French colony gained its independence by staging the only successful slave revolt in modern times and becoming the world's first free black republic. But that freedom came at a high cost. The U.S. and the world's leading economic powers, many of which still relied on slave labor, cut Haiti off from economic trade, and France demanded billions of dollars of direct compensation for what they viewed as lost profits. Much as in parts of the American South, the system of chattel slavery and anti-black racism consigned Haiti to an insurmountable economic hole. And that hole has shaped the country's relationship to the rest of the world ever since.
I think it's vital that we understand 1804 because the legacy of what Haiti continues to face in terms of its internal politics, but also in terms of this long legacy of foreign intervention, in my view, goes all the way back to the way in which the white Western world responded to the establishment of Haiti as a sovereign black nation.
Leslie Alexander is the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of History at Rutgers University.
Everyone celebrates 1776 and, you know, the aspirations of liberty and freedom from colonial rule. But when the Haitians demanded and desired the same freedom and liberty and desire to self-govern that every other human on the planet celebrated when the Americans wanted it, they were demonized for their actions and then forced through what we would refer to as gunboat diplomacy to pay an exorbitant amount of money.
For those of you who don't follow Haitian history closely, the country basically had to buy its freedom from France. It had to buy itself. France demanded 150 million gold francs in exchange for recognizing Haiti's independence, and this put incredible pressure on the country's finances for the entire 19th century, really.
I mean, just so that your listeners have a sense, 150 million gold francs in the 19th century, which is what the French demanded that they pay, is the equivalent of billions of dollars in contemporary terms. Most people have estimated that it would be close to the equivalent of $20 billion that they were being forced to pay in the 19th century. Even white Americans in the United States at the time thought that the French demand was absurd, and that the Haitians would never have any hope of paying it off. The legacy of that is that in order to meet the terms of the indemnity, in order to pay the annual installments, the Haitian government found itself in cycles of ongoing debt. They had to borrow from French banks in order to pay the money back at exorbitant, insanely high interest rates that created impossible cycles of debt. When you look at the media coverage in particular of Haiti, stemming all the way back to the 2010 earthquake, there is this level of accusation that you hear in the American media about Haiti being, you know, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. We keep hearing that over and over again. I describe it as a chant of accusation. Without a broader context of how Haiti became the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere in the first place. And it is largely as the result of foreign intervention and exploitation, obviously first beginning with France, but more contemporarily, it's the United States, right, that is largely responsible for the plight that Haiti continues to face both economically and politically. And if we are not willing to take a look at the historical roots of that, if we're not willing to have an honest reckoning with how and why Haiti finds itself in its current circumstances, we can never really have a healing of the nation that it deserves to have.
I spoke with Leslie Alexander about this over Zoom. We were joined by Eveline Trouillot, a Haitian novelist and poet. Eveline Trouillot, you live in Port-au-Prince. If you walk out your door, are the ghosts of the 19th century, are the pressures of everything that's happened since independence still putting a heavy hand on the daily lives of your countrymen and women?
Certainly. I think from the start, Haiti suffered from the reaction of the white Western world, and we are still suffering from it. And we know it also. The population, even if they cannot express it like that, they know that they are, you know, are suffering from the past, from history. And because let's not forget, when we claim our independence from France, we had to pay the debt of independence. And it was at the time 15% of France's budget. So it's scandalous to ask a country to pay that. And at the time, President Boyer thought he had no choice, because otherwise there was blockade against Haiti. There was no possibility to trade with any country of the Western world, and he had to do it. And of course, the United States replaced France after a while because of proximity with Haiti.
Here's Port-au-Prince, Haiti in 1915. Behind these scenes of peace and semi-tropic tranquility, there's uneasiness and unrest. Having suffered a succession of weak presidents and almost continuous civil wars, Haiti is now on brink of bankruptcy.
Following the assassination of Haiti's president in 1915, Woodrow Wilson sent U.S. troops to protect U.S. interests in Haiti.
15 United States Marines land in Haiti to battle Haitian bandits threatening destruction of American property. This fellow looks guilty of banditry himself. And soon, Swank Jail at Port-au-Prince is filled with Haitian insurrectionists under arrest by Marines.
The American occupation of Haiti lasted 19 years, until 1934.
And the population does not forget that. You know, when you occupy a country, you leave a mark. And you know, the population feel it like a violation. That's what it was. That was a violation.
Yeah, I just want to add really briefly that at the beginning of the U.S. occupation of Haiti, 80% of the Haitian government's annual budget was going to pay France and French banks. That's almost 100 years after the terms of the indemnity had been agreed to. And at that point, Haiti's governmental budget, 80% of it is still going to pay France for the indemnity. What most people don't know is that following the U.S. occupation of Haiti, the United States essentially became Haiti's new creditor. So Haiti finally pays off its debt to France, but it does so by borrowing the money from the United States and U.S. banks. And so the United States becomes Haiti's newest creditor. And in order to pay off that debt now to the United States, they are depleting their gold reserves. They're leaving the country utterly bereft of resources. Again, just to give you a sense of this, in 2010, shortly before the earthquake, Haiti sent 90% of its foreign reserves to financial institutions in Washington, D.C. to try to pay down its national debt. So the indemnity is not an ancient historic 19th century story only. right? It is also a very recent contemporary reality, which is that for centuries now, Haiti has been trying to pay off what should have been its fundamental right, which is to simply exist as a free and sovereign nation.
The thing is that most people in the U.S. and even in France, they don't know about this. You know, they keep on repeating what you're saying, Professor Alexander, like Haiti is the poorest country of the Western universe, hemisphere, but they don't know about it. They don't know because I had the opportunity to speak with students from universities in the U.S., Ivy League students, they don't know about it. It's not part of what they teach them in history. And right now, there are some efforts being done in France, I know also in the U.S., to talk about it.
And I think that part of the problem about people's ignorance regarding this history and this contemporary reality about Haiti is that Haiti then somehow becomes pathologized. It's like, what is wrong with Haiti that it is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere? You know, poor Haiti. It becomes this sort of victimization of Haiti, but it's pathologized in such a way that it's like, why can't those Black people govern themselves? And the reality is that we have to come to terms with why Haiti is in the circumstances that it is in. It is by design.
Has the U.S. been content to have a badly run Haiti off its coast since the revolution, since the world's first successful slave rebellion established the world's first Black-led republic?
I mean, I would go a step farther than that. I would say that not only has the U.S. been content, but I think the U.S. has desired Haiti to be an unstable, vulnerable nation from the time of its founding. The United States government, historically and contemporarily, has sought to disrupt Haiti's internal politics, to topple leaders and insert people that they felt were more amenable to U.S. economic interests. And it does, in fact, stem all the way back to the 19th century. Throughout much of the 19th century, for example, and this is something about U.S. history and U.S. foreign policy that most people don't know, the United States repeatedly, over the course of decades, sought to recolonize and reimpose slavery in Haiti. Some of the most famous attempts at that took place at times when Haiti was internally unstable. And I think, again, the historical context for this is important because a lot of the internal political instability that takes place in Haiti during the 19th century is the result of problematic policies that Haitian leaders put into place in an effort to try to meet the terms of the indemnity, right? The Haitian government is finding itself economically strapped, having to pay the French government, but not really having the financial resources in order to be able to do it. And so they impose problematic exploitative policies that are naturally undesirable to the residents of the nation. For example, they impose heavy and impossible to meet taxation policies, trying to find ways to raise money to pay France. And then people naturally rebel against that, right? So there's constant upheaval in Haiti. The United States government capitalizes on that instability and repeatedly attempts to go into Haiti, seize control over the government, and reimpose slavery. They attempted to do it in 1845, in 1851, in 1854, all the way through 1856, really all the way up until the outbreak of the U.S. Civil War. The United States government attempts multiple times to go in, seize control over the Haitian government, and reimpose slavery in the territory. And of course, throughout the 20th century, it's something that the United States repeatedly continues to do. We discussed the occupation, the military occupation by the United States of Haiti for almost 20 years. And then, of course, we see in the case of the Duvalier regime and numerous presidencies that have taken place in Haiti since then, the United States deliberately intervening and supporting the toppling of various political leaders in an attempt to assert governmental authority in Haiti that they think will best serve U.S. economic interests.
Eveline Trouillot, go ahead.
Apart from the political aspects, there is also the economic aspects. We are mostly not dependent of the U.S. for everything. We're importing things from the U.S. The rise, Haiti as the region of Artibonite, that was, you know, very famous for its rice. And now most of the rice that we consume come from the U.S. All the products that we have come from the U.S. So Haiti is supporting also the U.S. production. And our national production is all the way below. All the way below, you know? So this is part also of not only the occupation, but the intervention of the U.S. throughout the years. They forced us, for example, for the pork. We had our own pork. They deemed them, you know, they're unfit, and they make us import other pups from the U.S. And then now we have the rice also, the bean, everything comes from the U.S. And the national production is so low that the product, the national products are too high for the people to buy.
And interestingly, that is a pattern that also stems back to the 19th century. It's insignificant when you think about the size of Haiti, that in terms of square mileage, it's a relatively small country. But even in the 19th century, Haiti was the fourth most important trade partner that the United States had. Haiti consumed and relied heavily upon manufactured goods being exported from the United States. And even while the United States government was refusing to recognize Haiti as a sovereign and independent nation, United States merchants and the United States economy was benefiting immeasurably from its economic relationship with Haiti and the economic dependence that Haiti had on United States manufactured goods.
But, you know, the United States had that kind of neo-imperial economic relationship with a lot of countries. But none of them were as desperate as Haiti. What's the Haitian difference? 130 years ago, Frederick Douglass said the world would not allow Haiti a place in the sisterhood of nations. Is that just as true today? I mean, you know, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua all had post-colonial, neo-imperialist relationships through United Fruit and other U.S. multinationals, where U.S. interests own the railroads and the port facilities. The United States caused the creation of Panama, carving it out of Colombia and having the canal built. The United States is a huge power throwing its weight around in a lot of places. What's the Haitian difference? Is it still treated differently in the way that Frederick Douglass noted that it would not be allowed to join the sisterhood of nations?
I'd like to say something just quickly about the Frederick Douglass speech that you just cited, because I think at the core of that speech is something really important for your listeners to grasp. He delivered that speech in 1893 at the Chicago's World Fair, and it was more than 30 years after the United States government had finally agreed to recognize Haiti diplomatically. And yet Douglass is still very frustrated about the fact that Haiti was being excluded from what he described as the sisterhood of nations. But what's significant about what he says in that speech is the reason why Haiti is being excluded from the sisterhood of nations. And what he says in that speech is, Haiti is Black, and we have not yet forgiven Haiti for being Black. And I think that really goes to the core of what is significant about this story, that American, United States independence can be celebrated, and the American Revolution every July 4th, you know, we have cookouts and fireworks, and we celebrate the United States quest for freedom and liberty. And yet when Black people, formerly enslaved people, seek the same liberty and freedom for themselves, they are demonized and continue to be to this day. And I think at the core of this story is one in which the white Western world has still not forgiven Haiti for being Black, for being a nation that had the courage and the bravery and the audacity to be a sovereign, Black, free, independent nation. I think really what needs to happen is that Haiti actually finally needs to be allowed to govern itself, and that the Haitian people need to be able to have the sovereignty of self-governance and true self-governance without foreign intervention, and that the Haitian people need to have the ability and the freedom to be able to fully govern themselves and to be self-determining about their own destiny. I would say from my perspective, I would also really like to see Black activists in the United States have the same commitment to Haiti's freedom and autonomy and sovereignty as they did in the 19th century. And I would like to see Black folks around the diaspora rally behind Haiti in the way that they did in the 19th century. But I really think at the core of this is a question of whether Haiti is going to be forgiven for being Black, and whether the Haitian people are ever going to be allowed to have the freedom to fully govern themselves.
Well, you've talked about intrusions on Haitian sovereignty and the inability to let the country alone to make its own future. But right now, following natural disasters, hurricane and earthquake, the country needs help from the outside world. How do you square those two impulses? The justified by history desire to be left alone, and at the same time needing input from the rest of the world to help rebuild?
Yeah, well, I think there's two things. I think the first is that if other countries around the world, and I'll use the United States as an example, are going to help, they actually have to help. And what I mean by that is that using the 2010 earthquake as an example, the United States government pledged more than $700 million in recovery aid, and more than half of U.S. households contributed to the relief effort. But as a practical matter, almost 90% of those funds went to non-Haitian organizations, went to U.S. corporations, went to NGOs, and went to private contractors. And in fact, almost half of it went to the United States Pentagon. Even the United Nations admits that about 9% of the aid that was raised in the United States actually went to the Haitian government, and only about a half of 1% went to Haitian organizations. So countries like the United States like to brag about how much money was supposedly raised and given as part of the relief effort, but how much of that actually went to Haiti and went into the hands of Haitians? So I think when we talk about foreign governments helping, they actually have to help Haiti and not help private contractors and U.S. corporations and the Pentagon. Help actually also requires a level of respect for the other nation that you are attempting to assist. So as we were talking about before, you know, Haitian sovereignty, Haitian independence, the ability of Haitian people to be self-governing and to be able to make decisions for themselves, that has to be respected by other nations around the world. And foreign nations can't come in and decide that they know what's best for Haiti and for the Haitian people. They actually have to come with a sense of humility and a sense of respect around the idea that the Haitian people themselves perhaps know how the money can best be used or what is perhaps best needed on the ground for themselves. But I think the key issue is that money that is raised on behalf of Haiti has to actually go to Haiti and to the Haitian people.
Leslie Alexander is Associate Professor of History at the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies and the School of Social Transformation at ASU, Arizona State University. She specializes in early African American and African diaspora history. Great to talk to you, Professor Alexander.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And Eveline Trouillot is a Haitian professor, a novelist, and poet. She lives in Port-au-Prince and teaches French at Université d'État d'Haïti. Eveline Trouillot, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for joining us on World Affairs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you'd like to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And as always, we want to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there international stories you'd like us to be covering? Please send an email or voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Ryan Housel and Andrew Stelzer. Research and fact-checking was provided by Ryan Housel and Mo Fellows. Special thanks to Dan Zoll. This episode was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimpf. Additional production and engineering were provided by Rob Spate. Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.